Hello.
Hello.
Okay.
You're on.
Are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Okay. I'm Aesthetics, and this is Cryptographic File Systems. See, how many people here know anything about file systems? Raise your hand.
Woo! Not necessarily anything.
Oh, anything. Okay. And how many know about anything about cryptography? Okay. The way I'm going to have this presentation going, I was kind of gearing it towards a less tech savvy audience, kind of going to the lowest common denominator. But if there's anything anybody wants to interject, feel free, just say whatever. Go ahead. About me, I helped co-founded the Midwest 2600 with Ilanka. I was a speaker at Freaknik 7 on artificial intelligence and Freaknik 8 on cryptography and AI correlations between the two. Been an amateur cryptography fan for, actually Ilanka introduced me into a lot of it with her speech, what was it, 1 p.m. today, she was talking about the Freaknik 5 for the Freaknik 3 code. And I actually met her at a 2600 meeting in St. Louis years ago, and she set me through it, and I took a look and fell in love with the stuff. And since then I went with her to Freaknik 5, helped to crack the Freaknik 5 code, and I was also the first one to crack the Ilanka code. I've written several cryptography articles, some stuff that got published in K-Line. It's like a web e-zine for Hack Canada. Got a bunch of stuff on my website, just basic going through DES, things like that. Also have a lot of stuff on my website, just articles, book reviews, and gotta have the goat porn. So I'm going to go through, like I said, I'm going to take it through the basics, go through existing file system formats and talk a little bit about each. Go through Crypto 101, go through difference between stream and block ciphers, and then take that into cryptographic file systems and go over how the differences between EFS, CGD, things like that. Okay, so how many people recognize the FAT32 and NTFS? Okay, file allocation table is what was set for Windows 9X ME, 9X meaning 95-98. Fairly basic, not very advanced, doesn't have a lot of things. NTFS was the Windows NT version. Much more advanced, much more robust, had error correction in it, had, you could, oh yeah, journaling, definitely journaling. Journaling is a big thing. And NTFS is highly recommended for security. You can do much more file sharing with it. And then you get into less common file systems. You have HFS, hierarchical file systems, HFS Plus, which is the newer version. Is there a new version than that? Okay, and that's for Mac OS, OS 8.6, 9, and OS 10. You also have RiserFS, Riser file system for Linux, which is dealing with smaller files and dealing with smaller allocation blocks for files. You have ext2 for Linux, as well as ext3, which is ext2 with journaling. Various file system concepts. You have journaling versus non-journaling. Journaling, I'm going to get into that in the next slide. It makes it really useful, helps with data recovery in case you have a power outage and you're trying to copy files over. Compression, which is just another feature of different file systems. NTFS has that, where you can take a file and actually physically compress it to make more space on the drive. And as well as encryption with things like EFS, Windows Encryption File System, where you're able to go through the file system and encrypt it using whatever different algorithms, whether it be DES, triple DES, AES. And I'll also get into file systems, actual encryption of file systems versus programs like PGP, GPG, things like that. Let's see. Is everybody with me so far? So journaling is essentially, because in order to actually do something like copying, moving files, it's a very complex procedure. You have to allocate the memory, allocate the blocks on the actual hard drive. You have to update inodes, which when you're creating a file, you have to consider you have the file, the space that the file name actually takes. You have the where it begins on the hard drive, like the actual physical place on the platter where it begins, the length of the file, you have whether it's encrypted or not, what key would be used to encrypt with the data of the file itself. And it's a matter of making a list every time you try to copy the file. To make a making a list of where on the drive you want it to go, where on the drive you want the file to be, how long it is, and a series of things. So if there's a power outage or something, as I said before, if you have a power outage, something goes wrong, it has that list that it can go back and refer to. It generates, Journaling generates a list of these steps. Various cryptographic principles. Overview of terminology of encryption versus decryption. Encryption is taking a plain text and applying whatever algorithm, whether it be a substitution cipher, something very easy, whether it be something more complex like DES, a government standard AES, and encrypting it, making it so that it's the Alice versus Bob thing, where it's Alice to Bob. Encryption essentially makes it so that you encrypt a file, therefore somebody else who you don't want to see it can't see it, versus the ciphertext, which is Bob would be getting. More jargon, you have symmetric versus asymmetric encryption. If you have the difference between those two is if you have a cipher that can go one way, like PGP, for example, you have the public key versus the private key, where you can encrypt it and then you can decrypt it using the key. Asymmetric would be a lot of hash functions, where you can take a file and asymmetrically generate a ciphertext that you can use to correspond to the file, but you can't go backwards with it.
Okay. I apologize. Symmetric is where the same algorithm and the same key will take the ciphertext from the plain text or vice versa. The key is the same in both directions. Asymmetric is not hash related. It is that different keys and arguably different functions are required to go from plain text to cipher versus cipher to plain. The hashing is a different item entirely and a very important one too.
Right, I apologize for that. And with symmetric versus asymmetric, you get, I mentioned public key and private key. Let's see. Basic substitution ciphers, we have A is 1, B is 2, and you have plain text. I'm doing an example here where you have the encrypted message as the plain text. So you have A equals 1, B equals 2, C equals 3, etc. So the E turns into a 5, the N turns into a 14, C turns into a 3, and so on, and you generate the ciphertext message that's essentially jargon to anybody who doesn't know how the encryption works. Working keys into this, I was going to go through an example using a polyalphabetic cipher, which is taking a substitution cipher and essentially rotating the alphabet. And Ilanka went over this with the Visionaire Tableau in her Cryptos talk. Taking the plain text message 4 score and 7 years ago and ciphering it with the key of Lincoln. Working the key, you get the plain text of F. And if you follow it over, you can and cipher it with L and you get Q. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. And you repeat the key, or you can add pad into the key, depending on what the algorithm is. And you perform the operation for every letter. And the ciphertext message that we generate is QWHT, and so on. To decipher it using the simple polyalphabetic, you just go in the reverse. Q becomes L. Q using the key L becomes ciphertext F. And using the key to encipher and decipher makes it symmetric.
So it's a rotation.
Right, that's a rotation. Polyalphabetic is essentially a rotation. You get the same principle when you're dealing with like the Enigma cipher, which was a series of different rotors that were essentially rotation. You get into more complex when you're dealing with stream versus block ciphers. When you get into things like DES, you get into AES. These principles apply, as I was saying, cryptography is essentially the same thing, now just more complex. Like instead of using letters like I did in the last example, we can use hex machine code, and I'll go over how ASCII works. going over block ciphers versus stream ciphers, as well as operation modes that between every cycle of, say, DES, every cycle that you go through, you apply different, whether it be XOR, apply different operations, and it makes the cipher more secure. So ASCII stands for American Standard Code for Information Interchange. And it's every letter, number, and character in Unicode is numbered 0 through 255, and that includes different system commands, includes letters and numbers, like A versus A lowercase versus uppercase is 41 and 61 in hex. In this case, using ASCII, the word Lincoln would become 108, 105, 110, 99, 111, 108, and 110. And you can check out ASCIITable.com for more. It has an entire table that goes from goes from basic ASCII to decimal to octal. Hex is short for hexadecimal, base 16. Base 10 is what we consider decimal, 1 through 10, or 0 through 9 is what really is. That's why computers start out using 0 and go up through 9. Base 16, you notice the difference. Base 16 has 16 characters in it, base 10 has 10. So in this case, if you're trying to do a conversion, say decimal to hex, 510 a decimal turns into 15e of hex. So essentially, hex is just the same. It's the same number. It's just a different way to view it. It's a different base system. It's much more appropriate for machine code when you're dealing with hex, when you're dealing especially at the machine code level. And it's much more condensed. It works really well when you're dealing with bits and bytes, sets of 8 versus sets of 10 computers. I'm going to go through how the computer would see the key. If you have a key of Lincoln, as we showed already, going the key to the ASCII is 108, 105, 110, and so on. Convert that over to the hex, and you get something that looks more familiar to me, at least, is 6C, 69, 6E, 63, and so on. The computer sees this plain text as all in hex. We have 66, 6F, 75, 72, et cetera, and 20 is a space. And you encrypt that with the key, and like we saw before, you'd repeat the key over again if you're trying to do something that's longer than the key itself. And the ciphertext that we result is combining 66 and 6C, we would get 71, 77, 68, and so on. That's how the computer would see it. And it's very painful to actually go through this manually. I've done it before. It's why we have computers to do data processing for us. Getting to block ciphers versus stream ciphers. What we've been seeing so far are stream ciphers. They have a constant flow. Vigenere is a great example. There's no operation mode changes, and it's very fast, but it's also insecure. And fast is subjective. It's based on the computers you're using. Because if you're using a 486 that's running a block cipher versus a P4 running a stream cipher, obviously the P4 is going to be faster. But the cipher itself is inherently faster. Block ciphers are more complex. They're characterized by mode operations like a ECB, electronic code book, cipher block chaining. What those are, once you finish, say, a cycle in DES, which has 16 rounds in it, once you finish a round, you'll take it and you can XOR it with the plain text for coming for the next round. And it makes it a lot more secure. There are other operation modes than that. It's characterized by dynamic encryption. It works with data chunks. It's kind of like stacking blocks. And some of the more secure algorithms are going to be block ciphers. Stream ciphers are great for words. Block ciphers are far more useful with machine code. Like if you were to take a plain text chunk of 66, 6F, 75, and 72, and use an 8-bit key chunk of 6C, 69, 6E, 63, running it through cycles of DES, you would encrypt it for the first cycle. The DES zeros would be the first cycle, and you would result in the 8-bit ciphertext chunk. And DES would essentially be the summation with the mode operations of all of these different cycles. See, this matters because the computer sees files, folders as machine code. To encrypt a file, we're going to have to use a block system cipher. I mean, we can use a polyalphabetic cipher, but block system like DES or AES, much more appropriate for the computer. Why would you use encryption at the file level? At the application level, you're talking with the bare basics, know-nothings, people that don't even know how a computer works, and you're trying to get them to use encryption. Forget it. You get lost passwords. People get confused. They mess up. They're not really sure how the system works. Clicking a button is hard enough. Whereas using at the hardware level is expensive. It's difficult to change. Except you have things like FPGAs, which are really cool. You can actually dynamically change what the algorithm is. Some hardware is static, though, and it's very difficult, and it's expensive to maintain. Different file systems that deal with encryption. You have EFS, which is encrypted file system for Windows, cryptographic file system for Linux, CGD, which is cryptographic device driver on BSD. And like I said, there's also some programs. You have PGP, GPG, stuff like that. See, Windows EFS uses DSSX by default, which is usually main DES. You can enable triple DES through the group policy manager. If you want something more secure, triple DES is much more secure than DES. It's integrated into NTFS and includes features like Crypto API, which allows developers to add cryptography, digital signatures to allow verification to make things more secure through certificates. Other features with Windows XP, you can encrypt offline files, you can use multi-user file sharing with certificates, you can even use a password disk to you can use a password reset disk to reset the password, and encrypted files can be stored in web folders. File structure of EFS starts off with the file header. You have the data decryption field, which allows multi-users to share files, requires certificate management. This is the hardware where the password is stored in the user profile. Whereas the data recovery field, if there's an issue with whatever problems you might be having, you have a recovery field which helps you restore from that. Is this clear so far? Is there anything I can clarify? Correct. Mm-hmm. This would be stored in the inode. You have the file header and the file data, which is contained in it. The decryption fields, the password itself, the encrypted password, would be stored in the profile.
I'm just looking at this. Okay, you got file encryption key of the originator, the guy who's the public key of the authorized user. Mm-hmm. And you got two more keys for public key of the designated recovery agent. Just wondering, who is the designated recovery agent?
Designated recovery agent would be
system selected item so that the system administrator can get the user's data back when the user has forgotten their own logon credentials. Otherwise, the data is lost irretrievably.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Doesn't that sort of defeat the purpose of the security?
It leaves open a known other person you're trusting. So in a way, it's a defeat, yes. But in a corporate environment, you need to trust a key that's locked in a safe somewhere versus ever risking completely losing valuable information.
Right, especially when you're dealing with standards, when you have a lot of different people using computers, you have to have something that everyone can use. And that's one of the big things with applications, which is why EFS has to work that way. The basics on how EFS works, it opens a file for exclusive access, it copies everything to a temp file, and the FEK, the key, is randomly generated, and it encrypts the file. Then the data decryption field is created to contain the key, the field encryption key, and it's encrypted with the user's public key, the profile key. EFS then writes this data to this encrypted data to a file, and the temporary file is deleted. Whereas decryption, NTFS sends encryption, or it sees encryption and sends a request to the driver. The EFS driver sends the data decryption field to the EFS service. The service then retrieves the public key from the user's profile, and it's decrypted.
Private key.
A question?
Does this only work in a domain model, or does this also work in a work group environment?
That's a really good question.
Windows. I'm just curious if the domain controller, there we go, provides any of these credentials, or if that's generated solely by the machine and the installation of XP.
Okay. You can generate your own encryption keys within a work group environment, but you do miss out on key recovery and all the other things as the gentleman in front mentioned for a corporate environment.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Is a new FPK generated every time the file is written?
That's a really good question. I believe so.
And how strong is the randomness on that?
I don't know.
It makes sense theoretically. I'm not sure how Windows actually implements it. It would make sense for every key to have its own, because then the strength of the individual key is less important, because there's less data encrypted with the same key for a stronger analysis to be done to gather the one key back.
And especially if you rewrite the file, if you rewrite the file to different ways with the same key, it makes the key. So.
Sure. Yes. Okay. EFS can be done through the cipher command, doing by the command prompt. You set no parameters. It'll just display the encryption status of a directory. If you're using E, it'll set the encryption attributes. You can also use it. The example I have here will take whatever is in the C encrypt directory, and it will use the user profile password and encrypt every file in the directory. And you can use the D switch to remove all the encryption. Quick run through on how you can use EFS. If you take a file name, just an icon on the desktop, if you right click on the file and you click on properties and then you click on advanced, you can check on encrypt and click OK. And the encrypted file names are going to be in green. And you can actually change this if you go into the view tab under folder options. There's a checkbox for show encrypted or compressed and NTFS in color, so you can change that from green to nothing. Let's see, slide 42. It's a Discordian reference, and that's Lisp, set meaning 6x7. It's Lisp, artificial intelligence programming. As far as EFS goes, if you're interested in more information as far as like fixing corrupted EFS files, one of the most common ways EFS files get corrupted is if you're trying to, say, work on a Windows 2000 system, try to migrate to an XP system. If it's using a different algorithm, like you go in from DES to triple DES, or you go into a system that's running AES, that document goes through how to fix corrupted files. Q243035 goes through enabling and disabling EFS in 2000, and the top one is just a great read through on how to use the EFS in general, different good practices, and a lot of the information I have is from the Windows XP Resource Kit online, Part 3, Chapter 17. Going on to CFS, Cryptographic File System. It's based on a paper called Cryptographic File System for Unix, written by Matt Blaze, date, I think it's 92. He also has another one on, key distribution, key sharing, that he published either 1 or 2 years after that. Details some great background concepts, goes over issues that you'll run into in the workplace, performance issues that you run into. He has a heavy emphasis on portability and efficiency. As far as a file system that isn't bloaty, that you can run, that makes sense for your environment. And it's available at crypto.com as Matt Blaze's website. Let's see. basic RTFM, make sure it's enabled in your kernel. If it's not, you can download it, and you can run the patch at crypto.com/software. Basically, what you want to do is you create a new partition that's CFS formatted, and then mount the partition. And you can use different commands. CMake dir allows you to make a new directory on the encrypted drive. Catch allows you to attach a new file on the drive. Cdetach allows you to detach a file on the drive. Let's see. BSD, you have a cryptographic device driver, CGD. Encrypts things on the block level rather than, whereas EFS encrypts it in individual files. It uses AES 120-bit block size. Uses 128 up to 256-bit keys. Can use Blowfish, 64-bit block size and 128-bit keys, or triple DES, 64-bit block size and 192-bit keys. No, it's really cool. You can actually use DD, which it's a program that allows you to set a certain input and a certain input and a certain output. So you can even create a random number generator by having a, you can do IF, the input of the function as like dev random or dev u random, and set the output to a file that you're using or some input stream. And there's more on CGD. You can check it out at netbsd.org. And I'll have the web URL up on my website so you can check it out if you're interested in more on that. Let's see. Didn't have a whole lot of time to write up about transparent CFS, which is a BSD file system, but you can find out about it at tcfs.it. Apologize for that, I just ran out of time, and honestly, I don't know enough about it to do ad lib. Let's see, useful programs that you run into. PGP, pretty good privacy, created by Phil Zimmerman. He ran into some export issues with that with the NSA. Uses IDEA algorithm. One of the big advantages of this program, it's cross-platform. You can use it on Windows, you can use it on Macintosh, you can use it on Linux. Has integration of public and private key. You can check out pgpi.org for more information on that. He ran into a lot of problems. Actually, MIT was running this thing where you had the source code of PGP published. It's an open source program. GPG, which is the GNU equivalent, GNU Privacy Guard, also really cool. The way they generate randomness is they, when the program is run, when it's creating your public and private keys, it takes whatever's going on in the background on your computer, you can be typing on the keyboard to generate more randomness, and it will create your public and private keys based on that. General file system resources, you have The Hard Disk Companion by Peter Norton, which is, albeit extremely dated. It covers DOS, it's from like 88, but it's still really good if you want to get fundamentals on how hard drives work, how allocation tables are created, how the platters work, how actuators run. InfoAnarchy.org, hard disk encryption, and Wikipedia.org for file systems, both of which are excellent resources as far as just having information on whether it be journaling, new file system technology, and various cryptography resources. You have the Codebook by Simon Singh, which is one of the best introductions I've ever seen to cryptology. It goes over, Vigenère goes over the polyalphabetic ciphers. It breaks into, it gets into political stuff at the very end. It gets into, I'm trying to remember if it gets into Whit Diffie at all. Because I know Crypto by Stephen Levy does. That covers a lot of the post-60s. It gets into the Diffie-Hellman relationship between them, the knapsack problems. You have the Code Breakers by David Kahn, which is the authoritative guide of cryptology. It's, if you're interested in cryptography, wondering where things come from, whether it be the Jefferson cipher, whether it be the Vigenère tableau, anything like that. Any if you're just curious on where history comes from up through 1967, check out the Code Breakers. It's this huge tome, but it's well worth it. Also, there's the cypherpunks movement that came out of the 60s progressive culture. The Cyphernomicon, which is a really cool guide to ciphers that were being developed at the time. And it's still up, the mailing list. You can read through all the archives. It's at csua.berkeley.edu/cyberpunks. And that's what I got. Do we have any questions?
You didn't mention anything about OS X's ability to have an encrypted DMG file mounted.
Okay.
It could do an AES-128 file system.
Okay.
In the last two releases of OS X.
Oh, that's okay. That's. Is that a question in the back or just somebody?
Are you familiar with any of the upcoming hardware encryption capabilities that are being wired into some of the newest hard disks on laptops that have the crypto chip in them?
I know of, can you elaborate on that? Like, I know of some.
I forget if it's Intel or IBM, which is coming out with the chips, and you'll have to have a crypto chip enabled laptop. It basically is a hardware cryptography engine and storage
DRM
device.
Type or?
Pardon?
Okay, like hardwired into the actual card or into the actual processor?
It's probably a piece on the motherboard rather than a piece of the CPU chip itself.
Right.
And there'll be drivers in the operating system that can access it. But I think also some of the disk drive manufacturers are making something that can tie into it so that if the hard drive is separated from the machine, the data is encrypted with a key that is not on the hard drive in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
It's really good when your motherboard dies.
Well, in the same way that with EFS you'd have to have a recovery disk, for something like this you would too. The point being that taking the hard disk itself is not self-contained, giving you the decryption ability.
In other words, someone has to steal your whole computer rather than steal just the hard drive.
Right. And hopefully it would require an activation password at boot time, so even stealing the computer isn't enough. It's a multi-part thing.
You hope.
Keyloggers still work.
Just a self-destructor.
Just a question for the guy up front.
Sure.
You. I don't know your name. Do we know anything about the specs of that, whether they've been released by Intel or IBM?
I believe that stuff is public. If you dig around on the internet, you ought to be able to find it.
Okay.
Cool.
What are the keywords to search on?
You know what? Look in the last few months of new hardware columns for things like CNET or the public announcements from Intel or IBM, actually. Maybe your best bet to find it.
IBM's making public commercials concerning it, so I'm sure you know the IBM's hardware site.
Yeah, there are other cool methods of encryption, like with the flash drives. I was actually talking with some people earlier about that. Like, if you have a flash drive with the private key on it, and you have a hard drive that's encrypted with the public key, you plug it in, and it allows you to read it. It allows you to read what's on the hard drive. It decrypts it. And there are also I can't remember. It's like BioFlash or something. It actually has a thumbprint reader on the actual flash drive that requires a verification from your thumbprint before it even reads the private key off of the flash drive.
Thumbprint data encrypted, or can someone read the thumbprint data?
That's where the hashes come in.
That has to be stored somewhere.
The hash has to be stored, but hashes. Mm-hmm. One way hashes, you can't regenerate an image of the thumbprint from the hash, so that way you don't have to worry about somebody stealing your thumbprint from the storage device. You have to worry about stealing it from a drinking glass in a restaurant
or breaking the hash. As far as like if you look at like what's going on with MD5 and SHA-1 right now, where they can basically generate for certain hashes a file that will have the same hash.
Yes, creating a not the same but colliding hash.
Right, and if you combine that with something like retinal scans, it becomes even more effective.
Does anyone know of any?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a system that has a flash drive with a thumbprint reader on it, and then it also has a retinal scan, maybe even voice recognition. I'm getting into Gattaca here, but it does make it much more effective.
All right. Well, it goes back to the whole concept of the ATM card.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It isn't based on just something you know. If someone wants this one point of failure, something you know and something you have both, then the chances are much more likely to have a secure system. Nothing's perfect.
Right, and ATMs are a great. Go on.
I was going to say, that's what we have to remember about all encryption systems. Almost every encryption system that somebody has created has been broken. And the ones that have been created and have not been broken today, everyone believes that it will be broken sometime. It's just a matter of how much thought and power you want to put behind it.
Right, Bletchley Park is the perfect example of that.
Well, security and usability are two sides of the scale. I mean, the more secure you make data, the less usable for the general public that data becomes in that system.
Right. Which is why ATMs are four-digit PIN. Most people can remember that. If they can't, they'll just go to the bank and they issue them a new one. Sure, it's insecure, but it works on the general level. I mean, people can use it.
If a system becomes too secure, then people just bypass it and put in their social security number or something. And then security is meaningless anyway.
The post-it hole.
Right. What's under the keyboard. Is anybody look there?
Well, it's like going from a seven-digit phone number to a 10-digit phone number. Some places, they couldn't get it.
Nashville still doesn't do it.
I thought they stayed at five.
That's all I can remember.
Question.
Does anyone know of any encryption software that accepts two passwords, one of which decrypts normally, but the other would wipe or randomize the data in the file?
Self-destruct. It'd be more interesting if the second password had a fake file system.
There are point examples of both of those things. I'm not aware of any mass market products that do them because they have very limited application.
Question in the back?
Hello? Okay, there we go. I noticed on the EFS, you said the data is copied to a temporary file first, and then temp is deleted. How does EFF protect the temp files from being compromised, recovered, and so forth?
It's a good question, and that's one of the, as far as I'm aware, that's one of the big security risks. Is anybody familiar with EFS as far as how the temp files are copied? As far as I know, it becomes a big security risk, but the thing is, it's only for a very short time that it would be there. It's for as long as it's actually encrypted in the file, so the faster the system, the more secure it is.
Yeah, but it could potentially be recovered.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right,
when you get into magnetic scanning the polarities on the platter, I mean, if you want it bad enough, you can find it.
Or just a Windows crash and the temp file not be deleted.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You have to keep in mind what any technology is intended to defend against. If we're talking about something that exists briefly while you're using the system, and let's hope that they go a little bit beyond that and they actually wipe the temp storage after you. It's a good encrypting driver ought to do that. What you're trying to do is stop the guy who grabs the hard drive from your machine from being able to decrypt the data on it. The temp files aren't your problem.
Another question?
Yeah. I had an old Windows 98 system that died. I used the McAfee encryption on it. Is there any way to get the stuff back? I don't know what algorithm
it depends on. It honestly depends on the algorithm it used. Because if it's, I don't know what encryption the McAfee for 98 would use. But I mean, if it's something like DES, it's been proven time and time again that DES is crackable. There was an EFF project in 1998. They had the EFF DES cracker project.
It took, 72 hours, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they actually built physical hardware. The schematics are all available online.
Oh, it would be nice to get back what I lost. I don't need it or anything, but still.
It completely depends on the algorithm you're using.
Was the key something that you knew?
Oh, yeah. I remember the key.
I suggest what you do is take a look at the modern version of that program on McAfee's website and see if it's capable of opening a much older version of its data. It depends on what.
Well, I don't want to reinstall McAfee.
Because it could also be, you could try cracking it. It could also be some proprietary McAfee derivative of it too.
Have anything in their knowledge base about how to recover?
Right. Look to the manufacturer, the vendor first. That's going to be your easiest possibility.
It depends on how your computer died. Is it this way?
What died?
It won't come up. It won't boot.
It's going, it's partway through the boot process and just sort of stops.
Anybody got one of those, no, I will not fix your computer t-shirts, but for $100 an hour, I'll try?
Because, I mean, if it's booting up, you can try putting it as a slave in another system and,
right,
you know, just view it as data.
The application.
Right.
And that's where you would take the disk, stick it into a newer machine, bite the bullet, install the new version of the McAfee software, and see if it can open the file to get your data off and then throw the old one away.
I'm put it on my new system. That was a little bit expensive. I'm not going to risk it. Risk that one. Right, thank you.
So which one do you use?
Which what?
Which encrypting file?
I played around with CFS. I really, because I use Slackware Linux. Like when I have a computer, my current computer is crashed right now, which really sucks. Like, long story, power circuit blew on it. CFS is really cool. EFS is kind of iffy because with CFS, every time you try to run something, like say cdetach or catch, it prompts you for the password every time, so you can't just randomly encrypt things. Because so you don't even know what your password is. Say it's your grandma's computer, she doesn't know what her password is, and somehow EFS is enabled. You can go and start encrypting stuff on it, and suddenly she doesn't know how to read it. And just little problems you can run into. Any general questions at all?
Have you got a way with EFS to encrypt the entire hard disk yet, or is that a Windows Vista feature?
That's a good question.
I don't think
Microsoft
supports that yet.
Probably a Vista feature. Because haven't found out a whole lot about it, because I know there's the new WFS, the new Windows file system that's supposed to be with Vista, but it keeps getting, like, I keep hearing conflicting stories on whether it's encrypted or not, or whether it's included with Vista or not. So hopefully it is, because I'd really like to take a look and see what WFS has as far as encryption. Question? I saw your hand go up.
Okay. Just wondering if there are any block level options for Linux, because I didn't see you cover any of those. Do you know of any? Or
any blockable?
Block level.
Like OpenBSDs.
Right.
As far as I know, CFS, do you know of any offhand?
A friend of mine did it with the loopback driver to mount a raw device with encryption wired into the driver and the file system on this looped back thing.
Yeah,
it can be done. I don't know the details.
Okay. You Google for crypto.
Yeah.
You should be able to find about it. Plenty of stuff about it.
I had to step out for a minute. Did you touch on anything about freelist scrubbers?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Maybe that's a little out of scope.
Go into detail. Feel free.
No, I just wondered if anybody here knew. It's another aspect to security is keeping your freelist scrubbed, and also if you're encrypting through a temp file, you know, and that temp file gets deleted and goes out on your freelist, that needs to be managed too. But even without that, you know, do you have some ideas of aside from, you know, DD, you know, Dev Zero or something like that, are there good freelist scrubbing tools out there that kind of run in the background and slowly scrub kind of at a low priority and then have some kind of indicator to say that, okay, I'm done? Do you know of anything like that?
Offhand, I don't. Does anybody?
I have seen some discussions of disk wipe products that have the option of wipe only free space. I do not know if any of them will run as a driver where they just gradually in the background keep wiping free space over time.
Free space might not include everything you need to wipe. I was just thinking of programs like Window Washer. I don't know if there is a version for Linux.
What are the pieces that you're thinking of outside of free space that need to be wiped?
Recent file lists, documents that have been opened.
Yeah, that's at a very different level than the file system, but that's application control. You're absolutely right, they need to be handled. They would probably be in a different part of the product.
Okay, other questions?
Any more questions? Okay, I guess that's it.